I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Crime, housing, and snow removal are concerns that impact more than just Kansas City residents. Smaller communities deal with these problems, too. Today, a conversation with council representatives from Leawood and Riverside. We'll ask how the two cities deal with the challenges they're facing and what their solutions are. Then, a vow to end the HIV epidemic in America was made by the president in his State of the Union address. But how realistic is that goal? We'll talk with two Kansas City health experts about the state of HIV here and what it'll take to meet the president's objective. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Crime and affordable housing aren't just Kansas City issues. As we've learned in past visits with city council members from various communities in our metro, the problems the big city faces are often problems that smaller communities wrestle with as well. Now we're joined by council members from Leawood and Riverside. We'll talk to them about crime, affordable housing, and yes, good old snow removal. With us, Deborah Filla is a councilwoman from Leawood's 1st Ward. Deborah, nice to have you. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Jill Hammond is an older woman from Riverside's 2nd Ward. Jill, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, with this season's round of snowstorms, Deborah, how long has it been taking you all in Leawood to clear your streets there?
We actually are getting compliments. I know
really?
That's hard to imagine, but we do.
You don't hear that in Kansas City very often.
No, I saw on Facebook that the English drive on the left side of the road, and in Kansas City, we drive on what's left of the road.
No kidding.
So we actually are very fortunate in that we have a very planned program to mill and overlay and take care of the maintenance of our roads. And because of that, we have a good base.
Yeah.
But still, our staff is spending a couple days a week, every week, refitting potholes. And we've just about used all our salt up. So it's definitely affecting.
Hey, how many miles of streets do you know off the top of your head you have to deal with there? Yeah, because Kansas City's got like 84 trillion miles. Jill, how about you in Riverside?
Yeah, we have 91 lane miles to cover.
91.
Snow removal.
That's a lot fewer.
It's a lot fewer.
Yeah.
There's 6 square miles in the city, so much smaller than Kansas City, Missouri. But we, too, are ahead of the storms. We watch the weather closely. Our public works team does a great job of getting out ahead of the storm. While the storm's happening, they're clearing streets. After it finishes, they're clearing streets. We get lots of compliments as well. In fact, I've heard of neighbors saying that they look out their front door, their side streets are swept, the main arteries are swept, so they go ahead and feel confident for leaving for work. And then they get to our surrounding neighbors who don't have the resources we do, and they have to turn around and go back home because they're impassable.
Amazing.
So we have a great public works team that really works hard all hours of the day and night to get.
Have you shot through your budget for clearing the streets this year with all the snowfalls we've had?
We've definitely are over budget. We spent $175,000 so far this budget season on snow removal, more than we expected. We've used 1,400 tons of salt to do it. We too are low on salt. We just got another shipment yesterday, so we're happy about that. But we probably have enough salt for about 5 more events, and if we need to, we'll start mixing sand with salt to make it go a little bit further, because the salt locations are obviously lower in stock, and I've heard of up to a 20-hour wait for salt at one of the mines. So it's just it's a tough season for them. Obviously, they weren't predicting this as well, so they have to get in there. Get it in the trucks.
Yeah, there could be a national emergency for salt in this country that we're not even talking about on talk shows like this that we got to get to. Have you shot through your budget in Leawood there?
We are $240,000 against a $200,000 budget. So we still have 20% of our salt supply left. But as we unfortunately know, we're not through with the season yet.
And when you say that, you're saying you're over budget or not? You are over budget. So how is that going to impact other programs going forward? Are you already looking at that yet, or is it too early to say here, Deborah?
It's not going to be a major impact on any other. We do have a good cash cushion for these kinds of events. And in fact, because we have offered to take and pick up all the debris from this last storm. We have not done that since the October heavy snow we had. I forget what year it was.
Yeah.
But just like that storm, I lost electricity for 4 days then and this time. And we're still picking up those branches.
That's interesting. Have you picked up branches in Riverside, too?
We really haven't had a whole lot of fall. We haven't heard any major complaints. We do offer free mulching services. If people want to transport it themselves, they can take it to a spot off of 9 Highway that the city pays for any resident to take their own. We're sticking with our normal schedule of April and October for the curbside trash yard waste pickup. So that's staying in place. If we were to announce something new, our residents could find that on our website. But for now, we're kind of sticking with that. But people can always take it to that free service.
So, Jill, up in Riverside, are you dealing with potholes, too?
We try to stay proactively ahead of the curve on potholes. Our Public Works Department does a great job scouring the streets, looking for any issues before they become an issue. However, if a resident does notice something and they let our city know about it, we will fix it immediately. So we try to respond as quickly as possible.
Can you guys tell a difference when you drive on streets in your town versus driving on streets in Kansas City right now? Because even coming to the station every day, I know exactly where all the – they're not potholes. They're like craters.
Yes.
I mean, these things are just axle busts. And you got to watch out for them. Is there a big difference when you drive around?
I joke that you don't need to have a welcome to Missouri sign. You know exactly when you hit the roads.
You can just tell.
You can.
Yeah.
Ward Parkway is really, ought to mark some of them with orange cones because there's lanes that are absolutely impassable.
And it's scary now because people are weaving in and out of traffic because they want to avoid these potholes and you don't know what's next to you. Up in Riverside, same thing?
Same thing. Yeah. In fact, on my morning commute, I kind of have my swerves accounted for ahead of time because I know exactly where I need to
avoid.
In
Kansas City, Missouri?
Yeah, once I hit the Kansas City, Missouri line, I know exactly where I need to avoid avoid doing damage to my car. So, yeah, I'm very well aware of that, but don't have to worry about that in Riverside.
Let's turn to a different issue, and that's affordable housing. That's an issue affecting more and more cities. It's a big issue in the Kansas City, Missouri race for mayor. How much of a problem is it up in your town, Deborah?
Well, Leawood is in a very affluent community, and we had an average price for a home a couple years ago that was under $500,000. The average price.
And so is affordable housing even an issue?
Yes. And now the average price is $559,000 with the last reevaluation. Next month, we are, in fact, as a governing body, going to have a joint session with the Planning Commission, the Leawood Chamber, and the Economic Development Council to talk about future housing options.
Are you seeing a growing need even in an affluent community like Leawood for affordable housing?
Well, when you have your three-bedroom, two-car garage ranch being taken down in the maybe $350,000 and it's being replaced from anywhere from $750,000 to $1.2 million, that's changing the dynamics of our housing stock. So we're going to be very quickly in a position where I don't know who can afford the low end of housing in Leawood.
So, again, do you have folks who are struggling to make ends meet who need help with housing? Is that even an issue in your town?
Some of the original residents who are retired will be looking sometimes for electricity or natural gas heating assistance, and that is provided through other mechanisms. But not as a whole, I don't hear about it because they'll just buy a house somewhere else where they can afford to get into.
So what's that upward pressure on prices? What does that mean for Leawood going forward? What kind of challenge does that present? Because only certain people can afford to live in that town.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you don't have the diversity of housing. You don't have the diversity of population. So that's a problem, I believe. We always benefit if we have diversity.
And people are concerned about that, even in Leawood.
Yeah. Which is why we're having this planning session.
Huh. How about in Riverside, Jill? What's the affordable housing situation looking like there?
Well, I'm sure most of the people listening know that Riverside has had quite a history of having more being thought of as more of an industrial area with lower income housing. And we still have a lot of the lower income housing with some multifamily housing, some duplexes and rentals that are available. Some of the older houses that are, 50 years old in our city, you can purchase for $120,000. So we still have a lot of that. However, we are starting to see a lot of new developments coming in that are adding a lot of more expensive housing stock. Hmm. One of the last undeveloped bluffs in the Kansas City area is in Riverside, and it's being developed right now. It's called the Palisades, and I think there's going to be 84 new houses built on that, and some of those houses will be up to $1 million. They're starting around $700,000 right now, and they all have unobstructed views of the downtown skyline. So they're just absolutely beautiful, and we're excited about that and the new people that we'll be bringing in. It really runs the gamut in Riverside. We really do go from the very low income subsidized housing up to the more expensive $1 million homes.
Are you seeing more pressure, more demand for affordable housing in Riverside?
We haven't seen anything because we have some housing stock in that regard. So if people do want affordable housing, it is there. We have bus stops in Riverside, so people can, in some cases, literally walk across the street to a bus stop to get to work or to school or wherever they're going. So we are a pretty accessible city for the lower income individuals in Riverside.
How about folks who are homeless? Is that an issue?
It really isn't a huge issue in Riverside. We haven't heard of a whole lot of complaints. If we do see homeless individuals and if they're called to our attention, we do, help them to shelters in the downtown area. We help them to get services that they need. But it's a very infrequent issue. We have, one or two people here and there we'll see sometimes, but it's just not a real huge issue in Riverside.
Yeah. I should have asked this early on. Deborah, how many people live in Leawood these days?
About 30,000, expected to grow to maybe 45,000 when we're fully built out.
Huh. So you're not fully built out in Leawood yet?
No, probably 75 to 80% built out.
Is that a concern that becoming completely built out won't leave any available place to expand?
Well, the largest tract, we have about 800 acres of undeveloped area along the 135th Street corridor, and it's mixed use, so it's going to have a combination of retail, residential, and we're hoping that it will have higher density, and hopefully that will allow a vehicle where we can have a different housing stock. That's the hope.
But when you're fully built out, there's nowhere you can't add any different kinds of housing. You're sort of at your max. That presents a certain situation too, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. So 30,000 people living in Leawood going to 45, you're saying. How about in Riverside, Jill?
So we expect our 2020 census to have 3,500. We're probably at about 3,300 right now, but with some of these new developments I just talked about, we're expecting that to grow a couple hundred more by the end of 2020. At this point, we're a 6-square-mile community, and we're locked in on all sides by highways or the river, so there's really no place for us to build other than where we already are, kind of developing and building. So we expect that to kind of stay put. Mm-hmm. We don't think that more than maybe 7,000 people total could live in Riverside at any point in the future. So that would be like our max population that we'd be looking forward to in the maybe a little bit more distant future. But we're expecting about 3,500 at the 2020 census.
So in a town that small, then how many city employees do you have roughly?
So we have 79 full-time city employees.
Is that right?
And 20 part-time. And the part-time are more firefighters. So, yeah.
Still 79 employees. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, police, fire make up a lot of that, and then administrative staff as well. So we do a lot of development activities. So we have the staff to help support that. And so, yeah.
How about in Leawood, Deborah, in a town of 30,000 people?
We have about 200 full and part-time. And it's interesting that if you went back and looked to and talked to past mayors, when you wanted to have a street improved— and we didn't have a city-managed town, you would, as the council member, would have to go out and get the bids, let the contract, make sure it would get done, and then make sure they got paid. So nobody stuck around for 10 years, like 15 years, like myself and others. So we have a very professional staff that is really knows their stuff.
Yeah, and Peggy Dunn has been mayor now for how long in Leawood? A while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's turn to crime. How big a problem is violent crime up in Riverside? Is that an issue up where you are?
It really isn't an issue. We may have an occasional violent crime happen on a very rare occasion with lots and lots of years between each one. But no, violent crime is not an issue. We have what's more frequent is occasional car break-ins, you know, that sort of thing. People leave their cars unlocked in their driveways and someone might break in and steal whatever value is in there. But that's really what we hear of more than anything else. But crime really isn't an issue in Riverside.
You know, I live in Westwood and we get notices from our police department all the time telling people to lock your cars at night.
Yeah.
I just thought people did that, but then people leave their cars open and stuff gets stolen.
Yeah, I think sometimes it tends to be households with teenagers. The teenager comes home from school, they leave maybe their backpack in the car, they don't lock it, they just don't think about it, and then it gets, you know, rifled through in the morning or during the night, and they notice it in the morning when they get ready for school. So, but yeah, we definitely encourage our citizens to lock up their cars and their houses and keep garage doors shut and that sort of thing. That definitely keeps the crime lower.
What else keeps your department, your police department busy? What else do they do?
Well, we have a full high school in Riverside. Park Hill South is there. So that, monitoring that, obviously if there's any, you know, threats to safety, they will investigate those. We also have the casino, Argosy, there. Now, while the casino itself sits on the river and is Platte County's jurisdiction, the parking lot and the surrounding areas are our police's jurisdiction. So that keeps them pretty busy as well. And then they do a great job of just patrolling the streets and the surrounding areas. And they come through our neighborhoods on a regular basis just to make sure everything's okay and give our citizens some peace of mind.
To what extent does the casino, what challenges does the traffic there present?
Well, it's pretty well maintained. The infrastructure is pretty well intact, so the traffic doesn't really present an issue. It's right there at the outskirts of our city. It sits technically on the river. So when people come in, it doesn't really disrupt the flow of traffic in the city itself because it's not like right in the middle of the city or something. It's on the outer outskirts of it.
Yeah. How about in Leawood, Deborah? What kinds of crime situations arise there?
Well, we have had the pleasure or the advantage of having low violent crimes for the last 5 years. It was down 20% in 2018 from 2017, and in the last 5 years, we've had less than 30 reported violent crimes in any given year. So we're very fortunate it's such a low number.
Wow.
On the other hand, our property crime has increased 20% in 2018, and it's the highest we've had in the last 5 years. And Jill touched on the reason, which is a lot of burglaries and car thefts. And you obviously been listening to our chief of police, who's also telling you to lock your cars and don't leave valuables in them.
But more wealthy folks live in Leawood. Those houses tend to get broken into maybe at a higher rate.
They're not the homes. It's really the cars they've been breaking into. And it's not just our city. They actually have rings there's more than one that have been operating throughout the metro area. And they know of them and have been trying. And they have been successful in apprehending. But there's more than one ring. So it is a known phenomena among the police.
Yeah. What would you say then, bottom line, Jill, what's the most pressing issue in the city of Riverside right now? What concerns you the most as a member of the council there?
Well, it's really, you know, we have a very changing population, as we kind of talked about with our housing. You know, we used to have a much older population that were lower income. Now we're getting younger families and dual income, a little bit higher income families moving in. So really just managing the expectations of our new population while still keeping intact the expectations of our existing population. So that's really been a challenge. We had an ETC survey done last year with really high results, but there were a few areas for us to look at.
What's ETC?
It's just a survey where we ask our citizens for their input on our city services and how they feel about things in the city. And it's done through Facebook and they can fill it out paper and pencil. And it's available in a lot of different media, but we asked for people to respond and we got some great results from that. But we did find a few areas to work on. So we're really trying to focus on that as an alderman group to make sure that our priorities are aligned with what our citizens are saying they need from us.
You know, as you look at those needs, you know, why do people want to live in Riverside? What's the reason people come to move in there?
Most of the time, it's the location. We're 10-minute drive from downtown. We're 12 minutes from the airport. 635 is in our backyard.
Yes.
169 Highway is very close. It's just super, super convenient for people that have to travel throughout the city. My husband works in Lenexa. It's a 22-minute drive for him. He just hops right on 635 and gets there. I work in Midtown. It takes me maybe 12 minutes to get to work.
Right.
So it's just a really convenient area. We also don't have any city taxes on anything other than a 1% sales tax. So we don't city tax on property, real estate, any of that sort of thing. So that helps save our citizens some money. Trash pickup is free. We subsidize 75% of each household membership for the YMCA. So,
oh, really?
We have a lot of amenities like that. We have a great system of trails throughout the city that all connect and connect into Kansas City, Missouri. We have great relationships with Kansas City, Missouri for connecting into those trails and providing a good trail network and parks, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Why do folks choose to live in Leawood, Deborah? Just housing, what is it?
Housing, high education rates, great amenities, great restaurants, and low crime.
What are the amenities?
Well, we have a fantastic buffet of restaurants. Mm-hmm. We are very close to 435 to hop on. You can go downtown in 20 minutes and 10 to 15 to get down to the plaza. So it's pretty centrally located.
Yeah. What's the most pressing issue facing Leawood, at least as far as you're concerned, is based on your work on the council?
Well, there's a couple of them. One is hiring entry-level police officers. The pool of candidates is shrinking, and we're in competition with all of the other areas as well. In fact, we always have open positions, so if anybody's interested, please fill it.
Why is the pool shrinking?
Folks aren't going through the program. They aren't going through the training.
They don't want to be police officers.
Exactly.
Too much negative publicity surrounding. You have the same problem in Riverside?
We do. Yeah. We, in fact, implemented an incentive program. So if you found a person to be a police officer and they went through and successfully completed the program, you would get a bonus.
Really?
The existing police officers would get a bonus if they were able to recruit someone and they completed the program.
That's so how high the demand is.
It is. Yeah. And we're also competing similarly with surrounding cities and areas. But yeah, I think the negative press has probably had something to do with it. And yeah, it's hard to say exactly. But
are you raising salaries in Riverside for officers?
No, they're still in line with we have a minimum and a maximum that we'll pay, and we're sticking to that. So mm-hmm. It's just these recruitment bonuses are what we're offering.
What's your second big challenge in Leawood, Deborah?
The Kansas state attack on our constitutional rule, home rule authority. For instance, they've capped local taxing in the cities. And it's so ironic, since they're not managing their budgets and we are, that they should reach down and then try to cap our property taxes. So that is a concern. It's a constitutional home rule authority that they're overriding.
Yeah. Are there other municipalities in the region that you guys tend to look to or that deal with some of the same issues that you do? Do you have a mentor city that you keep an eye on?
Well, I think North Kansas City is a really similar city to Riverside.
Yeah.
They're not exactly the same, but they do also have a riverboat.
A little bigger,
they're
right?
They're bigger, but they do have a riverboat that funds a lot of their operations as well. And Parkville being close and also a smaller size. I mean, they're, again, bigger than Riverside, but they're a similar size to us. So I think we kind of look at their information. Sometimes when we're trying to make a decision, we'll compare what other, you know, similar size cities around us do. Gladstone is another one.
Yeah.
So.
How about you, Deborah?
Well, we certainly sit right next to Overland Park, Prairie mm-hmm. Village, Lenexa, Olathe. We look at all of the cities of the first class. One of the other concerns that we share with a lot of the cities is the fact that corrugated metal pipe in our stormwater systems are rusting.
Oh.
And so, for instance, we've had a lot of flooding. I don't know about everybody else, but it seems like 100-year floods are coming a little faster than every 100 years, right? And so stormwater infrastructure is really key. And to that instance, we have 20 miles of corrugated pipe that we need to replace at a cost of $52 million.
Wow. Big price, big issue coming up down the road. How are you going to pay for that?
We'll have to work out through our capital improvement program and make the trade-off of when to do the roads mm-hmm. and other infrastructure that's necessary.
Okay, I want to leave our good conversation there with our city councilors, Deborah Filla, councilwoman from Leawood's 1st Ward. Jill Hammond was here. She's an alderwoman from Riverside's 2nd Ward. Thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it.
Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Donald Trump's vow to end the HIV epidemic in this country in the next decade. How realistic is that? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Most Americans today couldn't pass the U.S. citizenship test. Yesterday's conversation looked at why and why we should be concerned. Hear that and more at kcur.org/uptoday. Tomorrow, Phil Glenn will join us as we continue our ongoing conversations with Kansas City's mayoral candidates. He'll share his plans to reduce crime and to tackle pre-K funding. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in his State of the Union address last month, President Trump vowed to end the HIV epidemic in this country in the next decade. But how realistic is that? After all, in the U.S., we're seeing 40 to 45,000 new cases a year. Worldwide, there are still 1.8 million new infections a year, or as one leading researcher put it, a number that equals a city twice the size of Seattle every year. All this comes as news broke this week that a second patient appears to have been cured of infection with HIV. Now a conversation about the road ahead for HIV and AIDS. We'll find out how many in the metro have the virus, their thoughts on the resources needed to meet the goal, and where the treatment of HIV is at today. With us, Dr. Blair Thettinger is the Associate Medical Director for the KC Care Clinic and the Missouri State Director for the Midwest AIDS Education and Training Center. Dr. Thettinger, thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Samantha Hughes is the acting division manager at the Kansas City Health Department. Samantha, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, doctor, this news that a second patient appears to have been cured of infection with HIV, how significant a moment is this?
Scientifically, I think it's a very significant achievement. But in terms of its what we can do to apply it to the people living with HIV now, I think it's a little limited. We have to understand that this patient had a deadly cancer and then received a bone marrow transplant
right.
as treatment for that cancer, but they were able to use the bone marrow transplant in such a way to actually cure the HIV, which has been done once before with a patient who was treated in Germany.
So your point is treating HIV patients with bone marrow transplants isn't exactly a practical way to move forward.
No, it's just not practical, and it's also not ethical, because we have very good treatments available for patients living with HIV that can control the virus and prevent them from developing AIDS. So we would not want to give them a treatment that would be so risky as a bone marrow transplant at this time. However, the achievement really does bring up some new scientific issues that could help us explore avenues toward a cure of HIV.
I was going to say, what is the significance here of this latest development?
It helps us understand where HIV is hiding in the body and how we could try to target HIV in such a way to eliminate these hidden reservoirs of HIV and actually cure the virus. And by doing curing this patient, I think it gives us some renewed understanding of that.
Okay, Samantha, President Trump made this very dramatic declaration during his State of the Union address last month. Let's listen to what he said, then I want to get your reaction to it. Here's President Trump last month.
My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years. We have made incredible strides. Incredible.
Samantha, what did you think of that? Did you have any sense that declaration was coming?
I think there was some buzz that he may speak on it, but I think the biggest thing is that we're actually addressing and talking about it, and that they're putting together a plan to help eliminate HIV and AIDS.
Yeah. What did you think of that declaration, Doctor?
I mean, I'm very excited that we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think it's great that the president's speaking about it. I really want to say that I like the words. I want to see some action, too.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think he made this announcement now, Samantha? Any sense with why now? Why 2019?
I really can't say, you know, why he made the announcement. Again, just glad that he did. I think the biggest thing we have to make sure is that we have funding that's going to be behind it to make mm-hmm. sure that that happens, that we support the initiative with testing and access to medical care and medicine to make sure we can accomplish those goals. But to be able to say why he said it, I couldn't tell you why.
How much more money does the federal government need to be providing compared to what it is now? Are we talking about huge numbers, or do you have any sense of that?
Don't have any sense of what those numbers are, but any amount of funding over probably what they have or in addition to, or some collaboratives would be great.
What's missing right now? I mean, what's needed that you don't have at your disposal to do what you need to do?
I would say from a public health standpoint, it's just the access for everyone having access to health care. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest piece, because when you have access to insurance and medicine, that reduces the burden on the client, a lot of times on the provider. We receive Ryan White funding, and we're the payer of last resort. We're like the gap filler. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that saves us a lot of money and reduces the burden off of Ryan White is the fact that people have access to insurance now. So having access to that allows people who are living with HIV not to only have their medicine as relates to HIV, but anything that relates to it, mm-hmm. that can help them with those social determinants. You know, they're able to see the doctor about their diabetes and about other things, which, you know, a lot of it's around preventative care.
Right.
So that's a big piece.
Is federal funding or the lack of it, doctor, is that a big issue in your world?
It's a huge issue.
Tell me about that.
So many patients who are diagnosed or who are living with HIV do not have health insurance. And if you don't have health insurance, you can't get access to the life-saving medication. So
that's
as she just said, Samantha was saying, you know, we need that Ryan White program, that federal program, to give life-saving medications to patients living with HIV. Mm-hmm. And I have read Alex Azar's, you know, statement on HIV.gov about what they want to do. And they're saying that they want to make a commitment to making new funding available and not just, you know, rearranging the sort of resources that have been dedicated to this crisis, but making new resources available to try to target this. And that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, and do you know what the president is proposing in his budget in terms of added resources?
I don't know what the president's budget says yet. I don't know if that's available yet. I know what is on the HIV.gov website. I know what Alex Azar's is making the statement on that. I know that Anthony Fauci from the NIH is speaking at the Conference of Retrovirus and Opportunistic Infections is going on right now to really lay out the president's plan, the details of it. So they have released some of those details.
You know, Samantha, when you hear the president, we just listened to him, you know, say that he wants to rid the planet of HIV in a decade, or at least this country. I'm wondering, from your standpoint, how realistic is it to think that, you know, in a decade there will be no more HIV epidemic?
I think, again, if there's the available funding, the partnerships around it, getting people to know their status, I think it can be a realistic look. And I think when they mean eliminate, I think they're just, you know, less than 3,000 cases of HIV.
So it will never be completely off the face of the earth.
I don't want to say one way or the other, because I'm not the physician, but I think it's a, you know, everything has a level, much like measles, much like polio. I mean, we have medicine.
Measles still exist, right.
But we have medicine for it. And as long as people are, you know, vaccinated for measles and they do what they got to do, you know, it's a rare case. And I think they're kind of getting it to where it's rarity. It's not the norm. It's not the what you see every day. And I think that's what the definition of eliminating the HIV is.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you have access to care, when you work at all, you know, making sure that people have transportation, they have housing, they have mental health services that go along with, you know, not just the prevention, access to our pre-exposure prophylactic, which is medicine that help prevent HIV. You have to have all those in place, and all that does take additional funding, not what we just have now, but as the doctor stated, we need something that's on top of that. So if he's making this statement, I hope he's making that commitment mm-hmm. to add mm-hmm. that additional funding.
Doctor, how realistic of a goal do you think this is?
It's not realistic to completely eliminate HIV transmission in 10 years, but it is very realistic to dramatically reduce it, and that would be very, very meaningful to thousands of American lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. what has to happen? You've talked about funding. What else needs to happen here? Is there anything else on the bucket list that's got to occur here to get that done?
Yeah, absolutely. And if it's actually written out pretty well. But here are the things that need to happen. We need to acknowledge that patients who are living with HIV need to get medical care, need to get good medical care. If they do so, we get to a point where we achieve where the levels of virus in their body are so low that they cannot transmit the virus to someone else. It's called being undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we have very good new prevention tools. Samantha just mentioned one. It's called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis.
I was going to ask you about it.
And
yeah.
If people take one pill a day, this pill, and we are actually going to have some other pills available for this, I think, in the near future, is able to prevent someone from getting HIV if they're exposed or if they're at risk.
Mm-hmm. And that's an amazing breakthrough, right?
It's a great breakthrough.
How long has it been around?
It's been actually around for five, 7 years. We really have only seen its really more significant uptake since 2015. We are prescribing a lot of PrEP to patients. We have a lot of patients taking it. The Health and Human Services is estimating that about 1 million Americans are at risk of HIV and should consider PrEP, and currently only about 10% of that number are taking it.
Samantha, why is that? What are you seeing out there in Kansas City?
I think a lot of has to do with stigma. People are afraid to maybe even, you know, take it back to when, like, birth control first came out. There was a lot of stigma around that. So, you know, now you have this preventable drug, and when people have so much taboo around sex, it really puts a big stigma out there. And that's related to getting testing, whether it's PrEP, whether it's even getting your medication. You're afraid of what someone's going to think, how they going to feel about you, or are they going to be shunned? I mean,
But if this pill is going to prevent transmission, though, that's such a powerful inducement, isn't it?
It is a powerful inducement. Even taking your medication every day is powerful. So, you know, if we can get someone to take PrEP every day to prevent it, we need to also work making sure people take their medication. Because as the doctor says, you know, when you take your medication, you're undetectable. So if you're someone that maybe is in a relationship with someone who's living with the disease and they're taking their medication and they're undetectable and someone's taking PrEP, then there's not going to be any transmission of that disease. So I think, you know, we have to have healthy relationships around medicine, around, you know, taking care of ourselves, around accepting what we need to be safe and healthy, then that removing those barriers will allow people to take PrEP and be more open to discuss with their doctor, their mm-hmm. primary care physician, about what their needs are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about President Trump's stated goal to end the HIV epidemic in this country in the next decade. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Samantha, how many people in the KC Metro have HIV?
There's about 4,000 people living with HIV and AIDS.
How does that number compare? Is that a high number for a community our side, or a low number? Any sense?
I would say we're probably, for a city probably about our size, we're about in that same range. The way that the federal government has it laid out, based upon there are a number of new cases each year. So there are other areas, just maybe like St. Louis, even though they're a little bigger metropolitan, we're still about in that same area.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, Doctor, I'm wondering, too, how you regard the pace of medical advancement on the HIV front, you know, going back any number of years. You know, after all, the first World AIDS Day was observed 30 years ago mm-hmm. now. Are we moving fast here, given the magnitude of the challenge? Are we at a ho-hum pace? How would you describe it?
I guess the thing I could say would be I think we've made remarkable scientific progress, and it's not been fast enough. And so I really think you have to think about the advent of the medicine that is able to control HIV, prevent the development of AIDS, prevent death. as one of the most amazing medical breakthroughs in medical history.
So I'm old enough to remember a time when we thought this thing could have consequences, catastrophic consequences.
It still can, very much so. But if patients are able to take the recommended medicine and it's diagnosed early enough, it can be very, very well controlled. The problem, Steve, is that we have a situation just like we do with diabetes or high blood pressure, is that even though taking a pill every day may not seem like asking much, we are asking it every single day. And so we do not have a cure. We only have control. And a patient must continue to take a pill every single day.
Is the cost of PrEP, is that an issue?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me get a phone call
PrEP
here.
PrEP's high cost is an issue. And I have many patients come to me nervous they will not be able to afford taking it. And actually, they've delayed coming to see us because they think they just can't afford it. However, we do have mechanisms at our clinic, KC Care Clinic, to make sure everybody could get PrEP. And most of my patients get it for an affordable cost or free.
Vic from Waldo, you're on the air.
Yeah, that was my question, the cost, and also how does insurance approach HIV treatment? Do they cover it, not cover it, et cetera?
Yeah, thanks. Like, what is the cost of PrEP?
The cost of PrEP, I would give you a yearly cost. It's well over $1,000 a year. I couldn't give you an exact number.
Okay.
But I'll tell you this.
It ain't cheap.
It's not cheap. Pretty much all insurance will offer some coverage. The company that makes it has some pretty generous copay assistance for patients who are uninsured. We have patient assistance programs. But the fact is we need to address the issue of the high cost of PrEP. And I hope that by the release of other medicines that could be used for it, that would drive down the cost. Or perhaps our government needs to take some action to lower the cost of this medicine, considering how important it is.
Samantha Hughes, again, you're acting division manager of the Kansas City Health Department. The cost of PrEP, how does it impact clientele in Kansas City, folks who come to you and say, hey, I'd like to take it, but I can't afford it?
Okay. That's a good question. I know, again, as Dr. Dasminger said, when you work with your provider and different agencies such as KC Care Health Clinic, Planned Parenthood, Good Samaritan Project, Truman Medical Center, they all work with the client to work with those copays. The current company now that has the drug, which is Gilead, they have a copay assistance. There are a lot of I know particularly at KC Care, they have what is called a PrEP navigator, and that person actually will help them through the steps to link them to other assistance that can help cover those pays. And not just your first one. They give education and reassurance on how to make it to the second, your second prescription and your third prescription. And a lot of it is about the education. One, don't be afraid to ask. You know, again, we go back to that stigma. Am I stigmatized because I can't afford it?
But if somebody wants PrEP in this community and maybe they're thinking they can't afford it, you're saying they can get it.
They can get it. Work with your provider. There are mechanisms in place to make sure that you can get it in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second part of that caller's question is where the drugs for treatment of HIV covered under health insurance. Yes, they're covered under health insurance. Again, work with your provider. We have mechanisms in place. If you are at a certain income level, then you're Ryan White monies that we receive in the area would cover your medication. Even if you're above those income areas, then we need to work with you to work with your own insurance company to get those medications. There's no one in this city that should not have access to PrEP or treatment. We will work to make sure that happens.
Hey, one key to PrEP, doctor, is that it shouldn't be used in isolation. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's one prevention strategy that should be considered among
condoms remain the other obvious one.
Yes, condoms are another prevention strategy. Absolutely.
You know, there are three large trials underway across the globe, doctor, in Africa and in this country. Each is taking a different approach. Tell us about them and what the significance might be of what could come out of these trials.
I think, are you referencing the vaccine trial?
Yes, I think that might be right. Yeah.
Okay, so there, like you said, there's many different mechanisms for HIV prevention, and our great hope has been that there would be an effective vaccine. And there was a big vaccine trial, and I think the date it concluded was 2008, and the vaccine showed that it was not effective, and there's been other vaccine trials before that. It was not effective enough. So there is another large trial going on. I think we're going to have results in 2023. It's being conducted primarily in South Africa, and I think we can remain hopeful that it will be effective, but it's going to be five different vaccinations over a year-long period. It's gonna be something. Even if it's rolled out and if it's shown to have some effectiveness, it's not gonna be 100% effective, and it will require a lot of commitment and a lot of resources. But could be a major and very effective tool. But I think we really need to realize that PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis, or what we call biomedical or pharmacologic prevention tools, really could. We could go even further with that. We could have an injection you could give someone every 1, 2, or 3 months that would actually act as HIV prevention. We could have a pill you take once a week. And these things could be coming actually within the next year or
so,
two.
So the advancements are coming, rolling off the medical assembly line at a pretty fast pace.
Yeah, so PrEP's here. Not going to be just, just Truvada, the current pill, one pill a day. There's going to be other things available.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say also, we have organizations in this community right now that are out there promoting PrEP and making sure it's available. I don't know if you've heard of Blackout KC, an organization that is really trying to promote HIV prevention among black, same-gender-loving men. And they really have done some great work in that field.
You know, Samantha, as you work with people on this, what's the level of panic these days when someone contracts HIV compared to 15, 20 years ago?
Oh, compared to 15, 20 years ago, it's not that same panic. I always have to come back to stigma. I think people understand that if I contract HIV, there's a medication for me. The problem is if I contract HIV, what's my mama going to say? What's my friends going to say? What's my family? What's my peers? That is the real barrier. Mm-hmm. I think they can go to the doctor. No, I'm going to get the medication. You know, they may have, friends and family who are living, you can live a great long life with the medication, but it's that whole fear of stigma and what people are going to say that is the big barrier to accessing care.
And medicines can't cure that, right?
No, that can't be cured. That cure for stigma is education, understanding, being able to, change some of your belief system about HIV and AIDS and for you to be a strong person when that occurs. So,
you're referring to the fact that there's nothing to be embarrassed about.
Correct.
And some people are embarrassed by it. Yeah.
Or just afraid. I mean, just remember back in the day when you couldn't even say the word cancer. It was the C or, they had it's just that whole trying to get past that stigma for people to take better care of themselves.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have to leave our very good conversation there. A lot to think about and digest there. That was the voice of Samantha Hughes. She's the acting division manager for the Kansas City Health Department. Samantha, thanks for taking some time.
No problem. And I want to say that I'm the interim HIV services manager at the health department, which is a division of HIV.
Okay.
So.
And Dr. Blair Thettinger was also here. He's the associate medical director for the KC Care Clinic. Doctor, appreciate your time very much, too.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yesterday on the show, hockey enthusiasm is growing, and we learned more about efforts to build the sport's profile in our region with Lamar Hunt Jr. You can hear that conversation and more at kcur.org/uptodate. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupdate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. On Thursday, women have played a vital role in the makeup of our country. We'll examine the impact that female immigrants have made right here in Kansas City. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.